Hello and welcome to Conduit Conversations, bringing you pioneers at the cutting edge of social change. I'm Paul Finsale, co-founder of The Conduit, a home for people passionate about positive impact. In this series, we're exploring the role that love plays in inspiring us to face significant challenges, such as living with cancer or mental health struggles. Throughout the series, created in partnership with Ralph Lauren's Pink Pony and Champion Better Lives initiatives, we'll hear from inspirational speakers from across the globe as they share stories of love in all its guises, from personal relationships to community activism. My guest today is Daniel Jones, editor of the New York Times Modern Love column. Dan has edited the column since it began in 2004. He got the job after publishing his book of essays on men and relationships, a response to his wife Kathy's anthology of women's essays about marriage and feminism. The husband and wife team were approached by the New York Times to edit a personal essay column as a duo. When Kathy left to work on a novel, Dan continued, never predicting that Modern Love would go on to become one of the newspaper's most popular regular features. Each year, Dan reads around 9,000 personal essays, covering every aspect of relationships in all their forms, from romance and desire to betrayal to illness. He has read nearly 120,000 submissions since the column began and published over 700. Dan now works on every aspect of the franchise that Modern Love has become. Two weekly columns, three books, Modern Love live events, a weekly podcast with more than 100 million downloads, and an Amazon TV series entering its second season. Who better to have as a guest in our series examining the vital role of love in each of our lives? Welcome, Dan.
It's good to be here.
So tell us what the phrase modern love means to you.
Modern love, I pretty much pulled out of the air as a name for the column, stealing it from the David Bowie song. We all wanted a name for the column that would be broad enough to encompass, in terms of not calling it like modern romance. Like, love was really the sort of deeper, richer, at times darker material. And modern is, again, a broad word that we intended as being contemporary, how things have changed or how technology is impacting relationships and that sort of thing, but not locking us into anything real specific. We wanted it to be a big umbrella that we could fit a lot of stories underneath.
So you're now in your 16th year, and I'd like to ask you, over that period of time, what changes have you observed in the kinds of stories people are writing and submitting? And what has stayed the same? Where's the continuities and the discontinuities in modern love?
That is such a big question. I mean, there have been sort of dramatic social changes in that time. There wasn't really much online dating to speak of. There was no gay marriage that was legal. Transgender issues were present but not spoken about in public, really. So I think the most dramatic changes have involved technology, meaning how we meet people, how we stay in touch, how we find intimacy. And then the social changes have just sort of galloped along at this incredible pace of accepting and mainstreaming different kinds of relationships that all used to be sort of hidden away and locked up.
So do you think it's fair to say that, notwithstanding technology, advances and richer definitions of sexuality, as you've alluded to, there is something deeply continuous, almost primal, almost innate in the way humans love?
Well, yeah, I think the urge to be intimate with other people is baked into us, and it's how the species survives. But that urge, the sociologist Helen Fisher always talks about that. It's baked into our being as the most important thing in our life. It's sort of what we're put on this earth to do. And work is one thing, and friends are one thing. But that power to connect physically and emotionally and intellectually with other people and to sort of pull them close is primal and baked in and unchanging.
Do you think it's the most powerful human emotion?
I don't even know if I think of it as as an emotion, as a drive, you know, it's a force that I think we deny at our peril. You know, I think some people get burned and lose love in tragic ways and withdraw. And those are always the saddest stories to me, you know, because it really is just sort of denying what life is to withdraw. And certainly people can reject love and they can withdraw from it, but that's not what leads to a happy life.
So let me ask that question a different way. I should imagine over the course of history, people have done remarkable things that are about generosity and care and compassion and kindness based on this force of love. But there are also moments in history where people have gone to war about love, where societies and clans have been ripped apart because of jealousies. And so net-net, is this force as you describe it something which in aggregate is better for us as a civilization or a species, or is the jury out? Is it capable of causing us to act poorly as much as it is capable of causing us to act well?
I don't know if I'd hang that on love necessarily. I mean, there's love and there's possession and there's hurt and rejection, and there's a lot of darkness that can be wrapped into being denied things and to want to possess someone. And I don't know if I would call that love. It's a different force. It's a force of insecurity and loss. But I think the thread that runs through, I mean, you mentioned the word generosity. I think that the thread that runs through love for me is that feeling of generosity, of wanting to do well by people, of wanting kindness to rule. The writer George Saunders, I don't remember if this was in a graduation speech he gave, but he was talking about how the biggest regrets he has in his life are not about career and not about work. There were all times when he wasn't kind in situations where he could have been. And I often think about that. Like, it's just, that's true with me too. You know, you look back at the times when you've lost your temper or done something that was selfish, and those are the regrets, you know. Those are the things that could have been so easily shifted if generosity had sort of been your guiding principle.
So I think of your column as an opportunity for education and wisdom and reflection and what to do and what not to do. And so I guess I'd like to know how you choose from the many thousands of submissions that you receive. What's your criteria for saying this one is going to make it and is going to be exposed to millions of people?
There's so many factors because it's a written piece, so it has to succeed as a piece of writing. But what draws me in usually first is a voice of someone who seems like they've gone through something. They're vulnerable, they're truth-telling, they're sort of focused on an experience that has affected them, and that the writing shows that. But I'm also always looking for some sense of intelligence, of a wisdom that isn't obvious or an understanding that isn't plain, you know, something that they've learned from an experience that teaches me.
So when you've selected a piece and you start an editing process, is that almost sort of quasi-therapy? By that I mean when you're engaging with a person and you think there's something really remarkable in the piece and you're trying to kind of extract it. That must be a different kind of editing than a business editor, yeah, you know, on stock prices.
I'd say full-on therapy. It can be. I mean, I'm very professional about it, and sometimes I surprise myself by just asking in almost like a reporter's tone questions that are incredibly private, and people participate in it. I mean, I almost always have it like an hour-long phone call with whoever I'm working with that week, and I don't necessarily come to it with an agenda. I've marked up their essay, and I have some technical questions and some content questions, but I just let the conversation go where it goes, and I'm usually looking for opportunities in the piece for more, for understandings that they may not have come to, or even more to the story. What happened after this? Like, this doesn't seem like the end of the story. What happened after? What happened before? And I just get people to tell me more about that and figure out if there are ways of shoehorning that into different spots in the essay or redoing the ending or in some cases rewriting half of the story to improve it or to make it more meaningful.
Do you have your own sort of sets of ethical guidelines when you think about what you publish? In part because I should imagine sometimes some of the most remarkable pieces of storytelling may involve acts which are on the borders of morality, which may place the person or somebody they love at risk, either actually or emotionally. And how do you balance what makes extraordinary stories with a set of outside ethical constraints?
That's a good question. We wrestle with those things all the time. Most of what we publish doesn't rise to that level of concern. And the stories that do take a lot of time. And it can be a story of contentious divorce, infidelity, anything where the person, you know, people are entitled to their own stories. We live lives with other people and we're entitled to tell our stories. But we have several levels of concern, I guess. One is I want to make sure that other people who are being written about don't contest the basics of the story. I mean, we remember things in different ways. Like my wife and I don't agree on how I proposed to her. We remember it in completely different ways and it'll never be reconciled. So I would tell that story one way and she'll tell it another. Hers involves me getting down on one knee and I don't remember that at all. I just skipped that part. Anyway, but that runs through everybody's life. Like how we remember something is important. So I just want to make sure that the basics aren't contested. And it's easiest if we publish material that doesn't upset anybody else, but that's not sort of the guiding principle. When things appear in the Times every single day that really upset people being written about, that filters into modern love as well. You know, sometimes the writer will get in touch with the other people in the essay. Sometimes if the stakes are higher, I will get involved with them directly. And I want to make sure, I guess, in a personal essay that the writer is mostly self-examining and self-blaming more than blaming others. And it's just the nature of that kind of essay that if it's successful, you're going to be examining your own behavior and you're going to be hardest on yourself than on others. Any essay that's blaming everybody else for their problems is, you know, that's as fun as sitting in a coffee shop and having your friend say, you know, she was horrible, you know, I'm never going out with her again. Sometimes there are legal concerns. The hardest pieces we publish have to do with, you know, rape or sexual assault, actual crimes being committed, and those take months. You know, we actually have to investigate the criminal record of those kinds of essays, but again, they're worth publishing. One of the essays I'm proudest of was about domestic abuse, where a woman was getting beaten up by her boyfriend, and she wrote just a stunning piece about it. Her name is Courtney Queenie, and the essay is called The View from the Victim Room, and how she sought a restraining order against him and all of that. And those are difficult pieces, you know, that it's the kind of thing where you're looking at criminal records and hospital records and dealing with the potential fallout of publishing a piece about someone who's violent and what could that cause. But I think it's important to be talked about, and a lot of people are in those situations and it's comforting for them to read about it.
I'm interested in, from where you sit, whether you think that it is just a conceit or whether it's in fact true that love can be deployed to heal, and whether you have evidence of that through your columns.
To heal physically?
To heal physically, to heal emotionally, to contribute to people's overall wellness is, you know, love is such a force. And we know through the literature that it's capable of, people's mental attitude has an impact on their physical health. So yeah. I'm trying to think about love in that particular context.
I mean, that would make sense to me. I can't claim to have anything other than anecdotal evidence of stories that turn out well, and you would think love would be a factor. I have to tell you that we, of these 8,000 or 9,000, however many submissions we're getting these days, it's long been true that about half of those are about death. So this is a column called Modern Love. You'd think it's about relationships and dating and all of that, but about half of what we receive is about death. And I'd say about 40% or more than half of those are about cancer. So we're receiving more essays about cancer than any other subject for a column called Modern Love. And I think that it moves people to write. We receive stories from people who consider themselves professional writers who are drawn to write about all kinds of quirky topics. But other people who don't write for a living or commonly are driven to write when they lose someone. And they want to figure that out and they want to sort it out and come to some sort of grips with it. One of our second most popular essay in the history of the column came out like 3 years ago or something. It was written by a writer named Amy Krause Rosenthal. And it was called You May Want to Marry My Husband. She was in her early 50s, maybe late 40s, and she was dying of ovarian cancer. And she wrote this essay as sort of in the form of a dating profile for her husband for when she is gone. And it was really a work of incredible generosity. It was just like, I don't want your love life and your sense of intimacy to come to an end because I'm gone. I want you to go out and find somebody else, and the sooner the better, essentially. It was this interesting tension because it had this light tone of essentially selling the merits of her husband to some other woman in the future, while this undercurrent was, I don't have long on this earth. And she truly didn't. The piece was very difficult to edit because she could barely speak on the phone. She was in hospice. She was that close to death when it was published. And by the time it was published, she was no longer really aware enough to appreciate it. And then she died within 10 days. And this piece rocketed around the world and was appreciated by millions. And it was such an interesting sort of wrinkle on death and loss and how to approach it with spirit. And there was nothing self-pitying about it. There wasn't an ounce of self-pity about it. And when you think of someone dying, you know, you imagine there's sort of a feeling of desperation at the end, and you just didn't sense that at all with her frame of mind. It was really a beautiful piece.
I read that piece and I was brought to tears by it. So I completely understand, which compels me to ask you what was the most read piece. If that was the second, I don't think I could take it.
The most read, which is the most read by far, by tens of millions of readers, is called To Fall in Love with Anyone, Do This. And it was written by a woman named Mandy Lynn Catron. And it was based on a psychological study of seeing if you could get strangers to fall in love by asking each other a series of questions, 36 questions to fall in love. And they were created by a psychologist named Arthur Aaron. And she wrote this from a personal perspective with this acquaintance. This was just a guy from her climbing gym. But she was fascinated with the idea of, can you make intimacy and love more possible through a game, essentially, through a game of asking each other questions that equalize the vulnerability. And it was so irresistible to people that you could fast forward falling in love that it really just became a sensation. I think it's one of the most read New York Times articles ever and continues to be. It just year after year after year. It came out in 2015 and people made documentaries about it. And I continue to hear about couples who met and married because of it. And the problem that it solved, it wasn't a gimmick. That was the thing. Like, often these things are gimmicks, but this was a gimmick that worked, because what freezes people in place so often is the fear of vulnerability and fear of letting themselves be known. And this broke that down with, you know, you never want to be the first person to say, I love you, because then if the other person doesn't say it, you're sort of left hanging. And this was like, I'm going to ask you this question, and then you're going to ask it back. And they start out easy, and then they get increasingly probing. And then at the end, oh, that was the other part, at the end, you're supposed to stare into each other's eyes for 4 minutes. And then after that, supposedly your chances of falling in love are increased. And if you don't fall in love, at least you've gotten to know someone really deeply. by telling stories about your biggest fears and your biggest disappointments and how your parents treated you, and goes on and on. People were just entranced by that idea, and they continue to be. And it has brought millions of people closer together.
The TV adaptation of Modern Love has been a global success, has been Emmy nominated. And there's one episode I'm interested in. Anne Hathaway depicts the story of Terry Chaney, I believe. And yep. She has a bipolar disorder that affects her dating and her work life. Can you tell us more about that story and what we can learn from Terry about the role of love in helping us overcome mental health challenges?
Yeah, that was such a powerful episode. And it's an episode that has impacted people who have similar problems or know people who suffer from bipolar disorder. The story itself, Terry Chaney was a lawyer, a Hollywood lawyer, incredibly successful, had represented Michael Jackson and, you know, different celebrities in Hollywood, complete overachiever. But to some extent, that all that achievement was a mask, because she would have these, I can't remember the exact nature of her bipolar disorder. It was something about rapid cycling, where you can get really high and really social and really sort of up and seeing the world in vibrant colors for really just a day, 2 days, 3 days, and then swing to a low where you can't emerge from bed and barely wake up for 3 days. So it's rapidly going from between highs and lows. And she would, when she was in a real up phase, the onset of this for her was as a teenager, I think, 14, 15, and she'd struggled with it ever since, but had hidden it all along, and figured that the way to overcome and the way to succeed was just to prevent anyone from finding out about that. And the way to prevent that was to excel during her up times. And she couldn't maintain relationships because of this, because she could only show half of herself, basically. And that half of herself would get her into dates, because she'd be very sexy and flirtatious, and she'd meet men and come on to them, and they would arrange a date, and then she couldn't follow through because a few days later she wouldn't be able to get out of bed. Anyway, Anne Hathaway played this brilliantly, I thought, in the episode, this sort of up and down swing. And where that essay and where that episode wind up is with her finally confessing this, finally sort of the breaking through this wall of silence and self-protection and confessing her condition to a friend, and how liberating that was to be able to expose your greatest weakness and your biggest fear of being rejected and have someone not reject you for it and have someone embrace you for it. And that has a resonance across all kinds of insecurities, you know, whether it's extreme in that case, you know, everybody's hiding their flaws or trying to. And to think that you could admit to your flaws and still be loved for them was just incredibly moving. That the scene in the episode, I don't know if people haven't seen it, so I don't want to give it away, but the closing scene, as someone who worked on the TV show, I saw that probably 25 or 30 times. And every time I was just sort of a puddle of tears. The effect of that never lessened for me, that sort of moment of sharing and intimacy and support.
We're going to have to get everybody who's listening to that to go and watch that episode immediately. Yeah. I want to ask you about your own experience of editing these columns. And in some ways, you could just think of this as a job, and a wildly successful job. You've taken an act of storytelling and turned it into a media franchise of some impact. But there's another level where, you know, you may be applying your job to your own life and to the way you love and the way you see the world. And are there discernible ways in which you think it has changed what you think about love or how you love?
Yeah, there are specific ways and then there are general ways. The general way, people have often asked me if I'm more cynical from having been immersed in all this for so many years. And that's not true. I'm much more of a romantic after having been immersed in this. I don't even know if romantic is the right word. I'm more of an optimist. And like, I don't consider myself a brave person who takes risks, whether it's physical risks or emotional risks. Like, I don't put myself out there in the way that a lot of these writers do and have. And when you see a repeated pattern of someone who leads a happy life is someone who is willing to put themselves out there again and again. And I'm not just talking about romantic love. And I'm heartened by people who turn away from loss or rejection and open their hearts again. And it's really the path to a happy life. Like, it's so clear that when that road divides, and you can either go down the road of walling yourself off from future hurt or completely exposing yourself to future hurt. The completely exposing yourself to future hurt is the path of happiness. And it's good for me. It's been good for me as a long-term project to constantly be reminded of that.
You have a 100-word column which really tries to capture love, I should imagine, in a far more precise and condensed way. What made you do that?
I'd long wanted to do a different form of storytelling. It was really just a matter of figuring out what the word count could be and what the limitations could be. A lot of it was just sort of inspired by social media and the way people can tell an emotional story in a really compact way. And I just thought there would be a forum for that. I wanted to get more voices into the paper and more of a range. So this was a project that started, it coincided with hiring this woman, Mia Lee, who is now my co-host on the podcast. And she'd been helping with the column for years. And she's young. She had just graduated from college and we hired her. And so that made it possible, essentially, to start another project. I had enough on my plate as it was. So she edits that column, and the 100-word stories with accompanying photos pour in at the rate of 20 or 25,000, 30,000 a year. I have no idea what it is. And she goes through them and finds what moves her. And it's been an interesting column for tracking through the pandemic, too, because I'm not saying it's an easy form to tell a love story in 100 words, but it takes less time, I think. So it's been a really fun project. It's successful. We have a book of them that's coming out in a couple of months. That was a really fun project. And they're stories that make you want to know more. And she presents me with this set of stories every week to edit with her. And in every case, I'm like, well, what happened here? And why did that person leave? You know, if you're really limited in words, it opens up this whole universe of like, what else has taken place here?
So I want to close by asking you a unilateral rather than a bilateral question about love. And that is a question about self-love or self-care, self-preservation. And especially in the context of coping with illness, there's a recurring theme of sort of turning love into yourself rather than viewing love in relational terms. And I wonder if that is something that has been a theme across your columns.
I guess I could say that that's increased as something that we get stories about. For me, the basic narrative of storytelling, what propels it forward, involves other people. So the self-love essay on its own, if it's sort of meditative and isolated, is a harder story to tell just in narrative terms. It's often an interior monologue. Not that it can't be done successfully and has been, but there's an element to Modern Love, the column, that is unlike other things in the newspaper in that it has a forward-moving action. It's really more sort of dramatic narrative storytelling. And often the payoff is at the end, where in a lot of traditional reporting, the payoff is at the beginning. I mean, it trails off to the less important stuff toward the end. You know, our stories will always involve, vast majority of them will always involve relationships with other people and things that can prevent you from having what you want. And a desire that is thwarted can be thwarted by other people and then overcome, if it's going to be overcome, simply for dramatic tension.
Daniel Jones, that is a perfect note to end. Thank you for a beautifully articulated, guided tour through love. And I'm certain it will be both inspirational and helpful to people who are contemplating and experiencing loss, but indeed to anybody who's waking up and trying to be human. So thank you.
Thank you. I completely enjoyed it.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Conduit Conversations, created in partnership with Ralph Lauren. Feel free to subscribe. This podcast is available on all major podcast platforms. To learn more about the Pink Pony campaign, Ralph Lauren's global initiative in the fight against cancer, as well as their Champion Better Lives initiative, please check out the Ralph Lauren website. And for more information on the Conduits and our community of changemakers, please visit theconduit.com.